A Penny for My Thoughts is the tabletop role-playing game in which the characters help each other recover their memory and, in the process, discover who they truly are.
I'm Epistory Richard, co-organiser of the London Indie RPG Meetup Group.
My name is Robert Cannell, and I am an RPG zine editor and non-award-winning game designer.
Penny for My Thoughts is one of those seminal games. I'm going to use the word zeitgeisty about it, because I'm going to come back to that, because I think it has a vibe around it, but also it reflects the time that it was written. Are we talking about this game because it's zeitgeisty, or is there something deeper?
For me, A Penny for My Thoughts is a game that is really overshadowed by its reputation. It's a game that I personally enjoy. It's one of those games where the mechanics are really clear. There's not a huge amount of overlap. There's not a lot of ambiguity in what the purpose of each mechanic is. But really, why I wanted to talk about it, or have one of these conversations around it, was because it is a game that seems to scare a lot of role players, a lot of indie role players. Like within our hobby, we gleefully embrace the inevitable insanity of Cthulhu and similar kind of games. And yet when it comes to playing A Penny for My Thoughts, the thing you'll most often hear around it is, oh, be careful when you play it. Or it's not for the faint-hearted. Be careful. Its reputation is really one that has been built not out of, I think, any particular intent by the author, but rather by how individual players have taken it.
You're right. Its reputation is built around what people have done with the system. And there are aspects in the mechanics that I think lead to a certain kind of play, which leads in an extreme outcome.
Yeah, the game itself is encourages introspection, and it has an inevitability towards it in a similar way to Cthulhu games, but one which doesn't give you the out of having a fantastical horror in order to let it feed. Is at the core of the game, at least the advice in the basic game, is one, to keep everything real, to keep the characters who you're building, who you're representing, are all relatively normal people, and they lead relatively normal lives, apart from the one particular thing that has led them to come into this situation.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fallacy that we're going to have to talk about the setup, because the fictional construct around the game is ludicrous, and it's one of my biggest issues with the game is that it literally makes zero sense, right? Because it's like, oh, let's keep this normal and keep it real, and we have to, because the proposition in the game is that a group of amnesiacs who have had a traumatic experience that led them to voluntarily lose their memories come together in a therapy group to recover their memories.
And they're injected with a futuristic drug that allows them to pull their memories and to have a better insight into what each of them did than they had of themselves.
So the super drug creates a mild form of telepathy, which means that while you're suppressing your own memories, you are open to the memories of the others around you.
I see no problem with that.
Really?
Is it?
Let's keep it downbeat and real with our super drug that evokes telepathy.
Granted.
Okay. I won't go on about this.
The premise is entirely a slave to the mechanics that he's trying to create.
Yes. Here.
Before we get into that, let's talk briefly around.
Can I just pick up another thing that you said though, because it's interesting, because there are some story games that explicitly ask the players to put themselves on the table. And this game comes pretty close to that, but you do always have a fictionalised element. So what's interesting is that it invites you...
You have the alibi.
Yeah. But it invites you to put real things into the game. And it's very easy to slip from what would be interesting to things that are kind of very personal. I think when people are saying, be careful, I think with games that explicitly ask you to do that, I think that's true. You should be careful. What's interesting about this game is that is an aspect where I think that fear that you're talking about is about people unconsciously slipping from, I'm contributing building blocks of fiction, to I'm starting to share my experiences.
Yeah, it's often referred to as kind of as playing close to home. And sometimes people want to play close to home. They want to deal with topics that are important to them, but in a fictionalized environment to allow them to address them or resolve them in a way that they can't in their real life. And some people obviously hate the concept of playing close to home. They want to maintain that distance between their avatar and themselves.
And so you kind of have this ludicrous sci-fi game that is touching on the very personal and very intimate.
Yeah, and for me, despite the, as I described it, like the whiff of science fiction around the premise, this is fundamentally a game about being real and trying to create stories around real people.
It's interesting you say that, because I actually think that Sleep for My Thoughts is at its best in its variant play sets, where it gets back to some of its source material. Now, one of the great things about this game is that it has design notes and influences and inspiration, and we've been reading this and delighting on it, and one of the cultural influences is the Bourne identity. I feel the game is actually strongest when you play into the espionage playset.
Yeah, the super spy.
And the other influence is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is one of my favourite movies ever, and therefore I'm very inclined to like it. But again, the idea of having... The game doesn't really follow through on that concept, but it's like the idea of choosing to forget something and then deciding whether you want to remember it or not is where I feel it's strongest.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly kept the choice in there, but I would agree that there's very few, in the games I've played at least, there are very few instances where somebody has turned around and said, actually, the reason I lost my memory in the first place was voluntary. By far, I think in every single case that I've encountered, in every single game I've played, every single character has lost their memory without their intent. They've either been struck by a disease, or they've been in an accident, or they have been in an act of violence in some way that has caused them to involuntarily lose their memory.
Right.
But let's talk about the intent behind it. I mean, the designer has been very decent to us and written us these designer's notes. But in those notes, he talks about his intent to just create stories, which is a very broad goal, and one that you could say was served by any different role-playing game. I mean, really what I see is his intent is to use very specific techniques that are relatively well accepted within improv circles and put those together in order to make a game that aspires after The Extraordinary Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is another one of the strong influences that he cites in his ludography.
I think you're right in what you're saying, but I think there's also a statement of intent about creating stories as opposed to what might be called traditional role-playing. It's very deliberately, it wants to have a start, a middle, and an end, and it wants to be about something focused. And it's not going to do it by simulation. So I think the statement of intent maybe has to be read in terms of the wider body of role-playing rather than a statement of intent within story gaming, where it's already accepted that the game is going to result in a story.
And the other thing that he mentions in his notes around his intent was his joy in unpredictable stories. And so really I boil down his intent with this is to create a framework by which people can create the kind of story that they would never have predicted that they would create at the beginning of the game. Mm.
I mean, I agree with all that, and add on top of it that it's, I think there is an explicit intent to explore the nature of memory, which is a very fascinating topic in its own right. Maybe not as strong in the intent, but there's the idea of being able to confront negative emotion in a kind of structured way. In that, I think as we kind of go through the mechanics, one of the things I want to highlight is how structured and safe this is, so that you can have powerful emotions at work on the table, but in a controlled way.
That interests me because, are you saying this is a safe way to play? Is it actually one of the notes that he makes is that you can trip upon difficult subjects and ones where you need to step outside of the game in order to discuss them first?
The game doesn't make any use of the conventions that we're probably used to now of lines and veils from Ron Edwards' Sex and Sorcery, which would have been available. And I think this is one interesting about like having someone who is not core in game design is that actually, there's probably a convention that they could have used to deal with those unexpected circumstances. And so what instead of adopting a convention that was known to designers, I think what he's done is created a stronger framework to try and make sure that the player has enough power to say no to things they find uncomfortable, but they do still occur.
Okay. Well, in that case, I think he failed. in trying. Okay. If that was part of his intent, he's certainly failed with that.
Okay, so I mean, the other thing that he mentions, which I'd also be interested in opinion, is that he was intrigued by the idea of having to bring the other players into your game. There's a number of games that do that. I guess what he's drawing a comparison is between the conventional spotlight play of games, that when it's your go, when it's your character, you are in the spotlight and it's about you. And this is one of the games where on your go, you do certain things to set things up and set things moving, but then you invite the other players to play with you in a structured way. Do you feel that part of it works?
What I would say about that is that it is a game where you are always on. It's not a game where when somebody else is in the spotlight, you can nod off or check your phone or what have you. Irrespective if you are currently undergoing the journey or you're a guide, you always need to be listening. You always need to be concentrating, because at any point, the person on the journey can ask for guidance and can offer you a penny in return for what may happen next. And this is something I'll return to when we talk about how effective and cohesive it is. But I certainly agree it's one that defeats or completely addresses the concept of spotlight. Something I want to say just in response to talking about memory. If I were just reading this game cold without the benefit of his notes behind it, I could almost believe that the entire game was a form of character creation. That by the creation of these three memories, a pleasant memory, an unpleasant memory, and then how you ended up to be in the situation of losing your memory in the first place, I come away from those games with a really good understanding of who that character is. But let's talk, we're already starting to edge into that area, let's talk specifically about the mechanics in order to delineate how he tries to achieve these goals. The first thing is the memory triggers.
So, yeah, which is one of the things that I really like about this game. Mm. And they are one of the things that kind of stand out as being something that's adopted elsewhere, but it's really nicely done here.
So at the beginning of the game, everybody fills in a number of scraps of paper with a memory trigger. So this is something that calls upon one of the five senses. So it could be the feel of fur under my skin, or the smell of oil from a burning engine, or the taste of my mother's apple pie, and so forth and so forth. And these are then used at the beginning of each journey, which is the game turn for one player looking to recover the memory for one of his characters. For his character. And the memory trigger then spurs off, then creates a starting point for that journey. So that memory trigger is then built upon by the other players around the table asking a guiding question. And this is something that is phrased as a question. So, for example, was that the last time you ever tasted your mother's apple pie? And the person going on the journey always has to reply yes and, which is a quintessential improvisation technique of accepting an offer and then building upon it. And then the person undergoing the journey consolidates everything that's been introduced so far by the memory trigger and by the guiding questions, and then begins their journey. But then your role as a player is entirely limited to how you think or how you feel about the situation or other innocuous activities. Whenever it comes a time for the character to take a positive action in some way, they are supposed to ask for guidance from two of the other players by offering them a penny each and saying, what did I say or do next?
Yeah.
And they will, each player then provides a different alternative for what the character said or did next. And then the player accepts one of them by giving them the penny, and then integrates that response in the ongoing narrative. Once the player has given away all his pennies, his journey is over. The concept of the memory trigger, the guiding question, the yes and, are all very well-known improvisational techniques. The ask for guidance one is one that, however, that I thought was very different. So it's very different from something that I had ever encountered before in role-playing, because it essentially flips the concept of character agency on its head. Previously, and different games have taken different approaches to this, but there is a concept that the player's agency over their character is sacrosanct. And where there are mechanics within the game that allow one player or a GM to take to cause another character, another player's character to do actions, they are always very controversial. In this particular game, though, you can never take an action or say anything of consequence for your own character. You're always, you have your choice between the two outcomes, but you have to take one of those two. Mm. And that, say, that was the first time I'd ever seen a mechanic like that.
Yeah, so the idea that a player has complete say over what happens to a character has a really interesting history, because obviously it's not true in the earliest games, because there's lots of spells and monster effects that make your character do things that you don't want them to. And I think as the idea of embodiment grew, that the player was embodying the character, if something unpleasant happened to the character, by implication it was happening to the player as well.
And this is where you hear the horror stories of in classical role-playing games, and not necessarily limited to those, but where terrible things are meted out to one of the characters, and it destroys the social contract at the table, and it yes. leaves the person feeling themselves personally attacked, let yes. alone irrespective of whether or not it was just their character.
And so out of that grew the sense that, you know, there was this sanctity. And I think it's only recently that we've been peeling back and looking at the psychology and what's good for the story, and saying the player is, almost explicitly saying the player is not the character. We want all the good things about embodiment, you know, the idea of, you know, really playing a character to the hilt. But I think it's a lot more sophisticated in game mechanics now, around rather than just saying there's total agency over the character. This is a good example. I think you're right. This is a way to kind of address the issue of authority in a way that isn't aggressive. You know, there is still some agency in the choice, but this is also where, you know, this be careful, this dangerous and dark aspect of the game comes in, because you are left with two choices and you are very at the mercy of the other players. Good players will engage with the narrative that you came up with, but again, there's...
Or look to develop it or invert it or, yeah, but yes. stay within the relative parameters that you are, yes. that you are offering to play in.
Yes, but there is the opportunity to take the absolute worst interpretation of the situation that you've suggested, make that the first choice, and then the second choice is just whatever the other person said, but 100 times worse. Mm. And at that point, you know, if your pleasant memory is, you know, being beaten by your stepfather, then almost exactly as I kind of complained about in A Taste for Murder, you've set a tone and it only gets worse from there. And I think it's the same flaw in both games, which is about being careful. But at least in A Taste for Murder, you have the safety of the fiction and the alibi of the stately house.
And you're also creating it yourself. Is that you create your own different levels of yeah. motive. Yeah. And actually here, the most dangerous part, if I want to use that word, in A Penny for My Thoughts, is not when you ask for guidance, because at least then you have the choice, mm-hmm. and you may get hemmed in by the choice, but at least you feel you have a degree of control over it. The part where you have the least agency is in the guiding questions, and there, because there you have no choice.
Yes.
You have to accept whatever is given to you.
Yes.
You can try and play around with the words with the yes and by building on it, but try to build it in a very different way in order to shy away from the thing you don't want to cover on. But fundamentally, if somebody says, oh, this is your pleasant memory, and you say, oh, it's the smell of leather, and someone says, was that the smell of the strap that your father is beating you with? You have to say yes and go through it. And you can try to move your memory on from that and say, actually, the pleasant memory is the comforting that you find with your sister after you were beaten by your father. Mm. But that event has still been baked into your character, and you have no choice around that.
Yeah. I think this is where... So the game is safety structured, but these things depend on some of the underlying fiction. The way I like to play it is to say, okay, let's imagine that the conceit is true. Okay, so we take the situation, the memory trigger, and we free associate to like whatever comes first. And then we kind of wrap it up into a question. And we use free association as a way of emulating this telepathy. You know, so you don't try and overthink it. You just follow a train of thought through. And then quite often that leads to a less dark situation, because you're not madly trying to go, like, what is the worst thing I can say here?
We're painting this almost a minefield of a game to play, but actually it really comes down to how much you associate with your character. And I have seen players associate very much, and I've seen a player as he's going on a journey, like, physically shaking because of the tension that's built up with him around the game. Equally, though, when I have come to play, and I have intentionally played close to home in my time, is that I have never felt particularly immersed in my character. I've always felt well in control. And I have found those times where people have been almost lighthearted or flippant or said something, like, off the top of their head, like, free associating, but one that they would never normally admit to, had been actually the most fruitful. Is that because I got a trigger which was like the smell of candles on a birthday cake, and the first guiding question I got was it your cake but your brother didn't allow you to your older brother didn't allow you to eat any of it, and I said yes and such a thing. Mm. And then the second question was, and was it your 30th birthday? And I had to say yes. And suddenly I was the kind of person who had an older brother, so a brother somewhere in his 30s, who was still acting like a child. And everything about my character then came together. If somebody had softballed me and said, and was the gift for that birthday a bike or something like that, then I've just gone, well, I'm still a kid with no real kind of root into the story.
I think guiding questions are, they're the interesting thing, because they can also throw you. My experiences of playing this game is that I have never had any of these kind of nightmare experiences with this game. In fact, I've always found it like a fun, but like the tedious side of fun. It's good, but it's meh. The thing that sometimes goes wrong is the guiding questions don't align. You know, that, for example, what is very clever about what the example you gave is that it twists the idea of a birthday party. It stays with it, and it deepens the initial offer. And sometimes, if you get a left-field question in there, it suddenly becomes like a technical exercise in mixing elements that are too different.
So let's talk a little bit about the lineage, so where this game is coming from. And again, thank you very much to the designer for giving us a chapter on it. So the one thing he mentions is that this is this was an entry for Game Chef competition 2007, where three of the ingredients were memory, drug, and currency. And you can completely understand. And that pretty much says the whole game for you.
Yes.
And
this is the problem with Game Chef, because it would be better without the currency.
He also cites...
and the drugs.
What's wrong with Nemesine?
Yeah, we'll come back to what the problem is.
Yeah. He cites The Extraordinary Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which he says is a particular favourite of his. And you can completely see the influence of that collaborative storytelling game. And he also mentions 1001 Nights. Again, equally, and there's this concept of using the dice as gems to offer backwards and forwards in order to ask further questions about the story that's being developed there. He mentions Improv by Keith Johnston, which, as I say, is a seminal improvisational book.
The other two that I want to mention are Don't Rest Your Head and Lacuna, because I think one aspect of the game as written is this completely ridiculous, over-the-top background that is slathered on top of a relatively decent story game. And it's the most off-putting thing about this game is how it wraps everything in its character and doesn't actually tell you what it's doing.
I absolutely agree with you, though, is that one of the things that one player told me was that A Penny for My Thoughts is almost its own worst enemy in some ways, because the designer made the decision to write the rule book in character. Because at no point, or not until the very end, does it say, actually, this is a game, and here are some of the techniques that you should be using, or that you can use in order to make the game better. Well, the first time I ran it is that I ran it as immersive as possible, as in character as impossible. And of course...
Were you wearing a white coat?
I was wearing a white coat. Excellent. And I had a clipboard. And what it did is it put the players on guard. It made them defensive and feel uncomfortable because it felt in a very formal setting. Every subsequent time I've run it, I've always said, this is a game, this is what the individual mechanics are, and this is what they're trying to achieve. And I've always had better results because of approaching it as a game as opposed to as an immersive experience.
I've always felt that this game is trapped between a trend in the mid-noughties of creating completely kind of isomorphic objects where the rules were the in-game artifact of themselves. Similar games, Time and Temp, where you fill out your worksheets, Lacuna, which is an instruction manual for operatives in the future. They may be in the future, but they're also exploring people's dreams. And the more modern design sensibility that says, I can tell you what the mechanics are, and I can tell you how they work, and then I can offer you play sets that offer colour on top of this engine. I was surprised to discover that it was published in 2009, because it feels so stuck between those two stalls.
Yeah, I mean, you compare
it a couple of years later and it would have been a couple of pages on a PDF and with lots of places.
Yeah, so we've mentioned the lineage, we've mentioned the mechanics. Does it fundamentally work? For me, at least, its goal was to create a character and to tell an unpredictable story. For me, it fundamentally does succeed in that goal, is that the stories I've ended up telling as part of the game have always been ones that I would never really have conceived of telling when I started. That being said, where the game starts to fall down a little bit for me is in its ability to tell a more coherent story. Because you are pretty much dependent upon your other players in order to reincorporate the things that have progressed so far. So if every single option that you keep on getting just keeps pushing your game further and further out without ever reincorporating previous elements, then you end up with not a story, but a series of events. The other struggle I have with this game, where you have four players, you have four typically entirely separate stories. And you are trying to keep in your head increasingly these, not only your own story, which is getting increasingly complicated, but the other three players' stories as well. And so it becomes harder and harder as somebody's taking a journey to remember what is going on with them and to think of an appropriate option for them when they go to you and ask for guidance.
Well, there's a reason why it's difficult to remember, and that's because you've lost your memory.
But what about the Nemesine?
Nemesine only gives you fragments.
Oh, no.
So my view is that this game does work, and the design works, and it's a very effective engine of what the designer wanted to create, which is explorations of memory, storytelling, powerful emotions, I think. I want to use that instead of dark, because they can be very positive as well. And also, it is very hard to play the game. It's impossible, in fact, to play the game without involving the other players in what you are about to create and giving them a lot of power over it, and therefore also being a kind of gateway into improv. However, I think to get the best out of the game, there is a role of the reader in the rules, who represents the kind of researcher who's conducting the therapy session. I think the game works best when you almost read out the explanation of all the rules in full, and even then people will get it wrong. Like, people will forget to say yes and, they'll naturally go to yes,
yeah,
but,
players
or there,
forget to,
and will not build, it will actually reject the premise.
And players, and I've seen players struggle with their journey, with their narration, because they're trying to say more and more things, and they've completely forgotten to hold up a penny and say, and what did I say or do now? Is that the game has given us this wonderful little mechanic in order to say, whenever we drive inspiration, we go to the other players and ask them completely within the game, and yet players forget about it, even though it's like the core aspect of it.
Like, you know, because also the other thing is in the narration, because there is that thing about like doing a strong positive thing requires an interaction with the other players. Sometimes the complete opposite can happen, where you stare into the fire and you look at the smoke and you look out the window and it was raining and there was a spider in the corner of the room. And sometimes you also need someone to go, like, you need to play stronger, because there isn't a harder, play harder kind of statement here. You know, like, this is going to continue indefinitely, because none of us can...
And you've got seven more pennies to give up.
Yeah, and none of us can get involved.
Until we're invited to, essentially. Or until you do something that allows us to trigger it. Yeah.
And you've got yourself in a situation where you're safely talking all about how you feel about the spider in the corner of the room. But this is really not going anywhere. So yes, it does work. And you don't have to know improv. Unlike a lot of the games we've talked about, you don't have to know the theory of improv. It's all the improv you need is right there in the book. It's all described in a lot of detail, but you need to apply it.
We've talked about how, whether it works in terms of its intended goal, but we also need to consider the rule set as a whole and whether or not it holds together. So for me, I mean, there are so so few rules in here. The concept of the memory triggers absolutely works. The concept of the guiding questions works with that caveat around the fact that it can force you into a difficult situation. The concept of asking for guidance works. One thing that the designer mentions in his notes is that you can end up going gonzo, and one player can force a game in a particular way by adding things. In the examples he gives are vampires and zeppelins and so forth. He mentions in there that there is no, and he deliberately put in there, no mechanic to dial things back in. There's no role in there, there's no ritual phrase in there to tell somebody that they are breaching the assurances. So, and the assurances are the things that he mentions there, where it says fundamentally, this is the real world, you are normal people, you are not super spies or superheroes or Cthulhu cultists or whatever, as part of the standard questionnaire at least. And I think really this is an example of how he is coming from an improv background in writing this game, as opposed to a more RPG background, where in a typical improvisation, actors will more normally go for more normal reasons. And it is far more frowned upon to go gonzo. And so he's writing with those kind of sensibilities in mind.
In the concept of the fiction, it says that if the premise of the game is that you are normal people and there are no vampires, say, and one of the characters chooses a memory that says there is a vampire and they were hunted by a vampire, or they actually are a vampire, then you know from the premise that the patient is delusional. And their memories are genuine because it has been picked up by the memescene. So you suggested, so you were a vampire and you were drinking their blood, because that's what that person believes. But they are delusional, which means that even if they recover their memories, they still have mental health issues.
The one point that I want to mention specifically around, is this particular element needed? And the answer is really a question, is the pennies. Are the pennies actually needed? In okay. A penny for my thoughts.
No. Thank you, Game Chef.
the currency ingredient.
For wasting everyone's life by having to understand the rules, apply the rules, get the bloody pennies to start the game with.
Trying to find the pennies in the first place.
It really doesn't matter if you just did it in round, and as you say, allowed a player who was stuck to just ask for help from a named person and then choose two people. Mm. The game is functionally the same. There is a strong piece of design in the pennies, but it's absolutely not the core of the game.
What we want to move on to now is, why should we play this game? Is this a game that we play for the joy of playing it, or is it a game that we play for another reason? And obviously, for my sake, it's not a particularly joyful game. It's not a game where you have big laughs. It's typically quite a quiet game. It's quite serious. It's often, bizarrely, a game that I think actually works quite well at conventions, because it is quiet and because it's always obvious who is talking. There's no talking over each other, and everyone is comfortable like leaning in and hearing each other, so you don't create a huge amount of noise for the tables next to you. But the value in playing the game is one, as I say, for me, it's one around creating a new character and creating a character who, by the end of the game, I actually feel really quite comfortable explaining that character to somebody else, or even portraying that character in a subsequent game or play or improvisation or whatever.
Yeah, so this is...
Do you find it... Is it a game that you play for the enjoyment of the game, for the joy of it, or...?
No, I mean, I would only really play it because I had to.
Who is out there forcing you to play these games? Apart from me, obviously.
Apart from you. I think it's a good introduction. You know, because it's solid, it is so solid, and it's put together, and you can't really do much wrong. But at the same time, it kind of lacks excitement. And I think also the default fiction and the default questions you ask are just really dull. Some of the variants are much more exciting. I think the Super Spy one is like, what you're suppressing is like how the mission got compromised. You know, so if you think of something like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, you know, who is the defector? Or, you know, who's the traitor? None of the people coming back from the mission can remember. And you're
That's
trying
a good
to
idea. I know of another spin-off to it, which was A Penny for My Hangover, which is where you're trying to remember what happened after a drug night out, which, again, is a way of using the same mechanics, but again, it's you know, these are solid mechanics that just haven't been taken up and used a huge amount, even though they may well have influenced other people's gaming and specifically encourage people to start playing more real or closer to home. How has this game contributed to the ongoing conversation around RPG design, if it has at all? Has it had a direct influence on other games, or are there things about it that we should point out for other designers to use?
Memory triggers are a really simple, effective mechanism. They've got a structure because they have to involve a sense. Again, I think it's quite helpful when you're creating them if you kind of free associate, take the first image that's in your mind and then kind of associate a sense with it. You get quite evocative situations that often seem, because they are vague and open to interpretation, towards the end of the game, people are going like, oh, this is an amazing memory trigger. It fits exactly with my story.
Yeah.
And you're like, yep, thousands of other stories, but yeah, you know.
One of the things that we've spoken about several times is scene framing. When we talked about Microscope, we talked about, actually, this is a really useful way of framing a scene, about posing a question. And we tried to think about other ways that people have used to frame a scene. And when we're talking about Durance, we said one of the problems with Durance is that the scene framer is not framing a scene with his own character in, which kind of places other people kind of on the back foot. And this is a very different way of essentially framing a scene, which is what we're trying to do.
It is a question, ultimately. It is Microscope, like, you know, what is your pleasant memory, what is your unpleasant memory? But it gives you more structure to ease into it, because you have something that hopefully invokes an emotional response in you and a number of points of fact that you're trying to incorporate. And each point of fact will have an element that you didn't contribute, but also a contribution you made.
So I entirely agree with you. I think there's scope for inclusion of this kind of the memory trigger concept in other game design.
The other thing is the branching narrative, which kind of exists here preserved on its own, but there are other games that use that. I'm thinking particularly of Intrepid, which explicitly creates these forks in narratives. And I want to say that Spark as well has a very similar thing, where there's branching opportunities. It's an interesting way of creating narrative that moves on in an unpredictable way, but does move on.
I mean, for me, it's one that mechanism of the branching narrative of being able to go to two different people and ask what happens next. I have taken that mechanism out of A Penny for My Thoughts and placed it in Powered by the Apocalypse games, and use it to replace an MC hard move.
So I think the final one, so at the end of the game, all the players hold hands and say A Penny for My Thoughts. So this is one of these games that has led to that kind of hippie wood folk impression of story games. And also, you know, the idea like, oh my god, it's like all these story gamers, they want to touch you and hold your hand, and you know, it's awful, and I just want to be a repressed nerd. One of the things that this game does is allow you to play with strong emotion and reminds you where that emotion comes from and who's responsible for it, which is the players. It has a lot of nice touches all the way through the game, and the holding hands at the end is to an extent, it is saying it's only a game.
I mean, for me, the memory triggers, absolutely, as you say, there's almost a negative example in there of don't write your book in character. Don't write your game in character.
Please don't do that. because I think we're all a little more grown up now, right?
Yeah. And
I think,
but it's a wonder. I can completely understand why it was done. And I can completely imagine being a designer sitting there going, oh, this is a great idea, completely immersing them from the off. But it's just no. The other thing I would mention is an awful lot of the reputation that the game has built around it is because on the basic questionnaire or the basic memories you have to fill in, the last one is around losing your memories. You have to state how you came to lose your memories, which is often associated with a moment of trauma, which leads people towards violence, accidents, and or diseases.
So, I mean, let's be clear, right? Unless this is going to be the sad game about dementia, there is no way that you can have a game about losing your memory that doesn't imply trauma to me.
So exactly, and that says is. But if you just replaced that single word with saying with the last one, which was define how your memory came to be wiped as part of the Super Soldier Project or something like that, you completely change not only that last memory but every single memory that goes before it, because that one sentence or that one indication that you will suffer a point of trauma at some time in your future completely colours your entire experience up to it. And for me, it's a demonstration of how of the care and consideration you have to take with your words, but also the power that changing a single word can make. The final question around it: should it be part of the canon?
I mean, so I feel very conflicted about this, because if you take all the craft off and you look at the mechanism, because they are drawn on a foundation of really strong practical experience from improvisation, there's a bit of game design around it, but the core elements are really about a structured, improvised scene.
But let me ask you that. But you've had games you found boring. There have been memories where they haven't turned back on themselves properly. They haven't kind of reincorporated properly, and they've just kind of gone from event to event to event. You've had games that have there have been games where gonzo elements have been introduced, and there's been no way of hauling them back. For me, is that I do enjoy playing this game, and I enjoy the characters that come out of it. I take the game seriously, and it's not a game full of laughs, but it is an interesting character creation exercise. But it is not consistent in its delivery of its goal. It produces unpredictable stories, yes, but does it produce satisfying stories? And this is, and I'm going to hold you to this thing that you mentioned around A Taste for Murder. You said, like, the mysteries that A Taste for Murder creates aren't satisfying. Yeah, I agreed with you there, and you talked me around A Taste for Murder. And equally, here, a lot of the stories that it creates are unpredictable, but a lot of them aren't satisfying.
The game design intent is met, and I think what we're saying is that is not enough.
The ambition was not enough. The ambition to build unpredictable stories is good, and it succeeds in that.
And the ambition to have a game that forces you to incorporate the other player, to interact with the other players, take on board their ideas. And I think that's a really interesting contrast with a lot of games.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the other players. I found it innovative. A game that allows you to play in a different space from a lot of other role-playing games. And a game that almost has a tantalizing game, because it's like, oh, you're doing the hard stuff. You're playing Penny. It's like you're watching the movie from The Ring, you know? You'll never be the same again. But not part of the canon.
No.
For me, no.
No, I agree.
So Penny for My Thoughts is a game where a bunch of amnesiacs come together and with the aid of a magical drug recover their memories in a calming, therapeutic session.
It's science fiction, not magic, okay? It happens in the future.
So as part of that science, we could also look at Psyrun, the game of mutant psychics who have lost their memories and are on the run from some malignant force that is chasing them. Obviously, they've lost their memories, but they're going to recover them by investigating their own past and looking at what's in their pockets.
And kicking ass.
Yes. It's also, we talked about how Penny put a barrier for new people. It seemed intimidating. Psyrun is a game that admittedly does play on genre tropes, but is ideal for beginners who want to get into story games and explore character rather than action, as it provides a structure which is familiar, but ultimately drives the players to look into themselves.